Well, Penny Abernathy used to work for the Wall Street Journal and also with the New York Times. She's now in Chapel Hill as the night chair in journalism and digital media economics right here at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And she's the author and coordinator of a new book called Saving Community Journalism, The Path to Profitability. Penny Abernathy, welcome.
Thank you.
You're a North Carolina girl.
I absolutely am. I was born in Scotland County, along with quite a few other journalists around here and in the state.
I'll ask you, where did you get your start in journalism?
Actually, I got my start at the Larnberry Exchange, working, I walked down after I graduated from high school. I had edited the Bagpipe in high school, and walked in and needed a summer job. And I said to John Henry Moore, who was then the owner and editor, that I thought I was ready to write for the Larnberry Exchange. He hired me to cover American Legion baseball and do anything else he threw my way, which was a lot. It was everything from editing community news to writing weather stories to doing the latest on the 4-H contest all around. I fell in love with it. My first big interview occurred the first week I was there. Jim Beatty, who had just won the indoor 4-minute mile, came through town, and he suggested that I was a good interviewer. I'm not sure I was, but it was a very inspirational thing, so I decided then and there I was going to be a journalist.
How old were you then?
I was 18.
So this is the summer after high school?
It was the summer after high school. I went off to, at that point, it was very glamorous to think of yourself as a sportscaster. So I went off to UNCG and took speech the first semester. And at the end of the first semester, the speech teacher informed me that she thought I needed lots of remedial help. So I decided I could write. I moved over into the newspaper side of things. Interestingly enough, some years later when I was...
Can we get off on a different track just for a second? Because I'm right in the middle of Walt Wolfram's book about North Carolina speech and speech patterns, and his message is these are beautiful speech patterns. But the UNCG professor, did she say, "Hey, Penny, you talk like a girl from Scotland County. We can't make you into a deep." Radio and television announcer. Is that what happened?
That is absolutely what happened. And if you think back then, everyone who aspired to the networks or to broadcasting aspired for that Midwest non-accent that was there. Fred Graham was actually the first of the people I remember having a distinguished accent. On television, and it was actually inspirational for me. Interestingly enough, I want to follow this accent piece. What was so amazing to me was when I got to the places like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, the first women on the masthead there had accents just as thick as mine.
They had
the same experience in college where somebody had said to them, you know, you've got to lose the Southern accent if you ever want to be a journalist. Simmons College, someone told me several years ago, Simmons College did a study of women who had succeeded in executive roles in places like New York City and kept the Southern accent. And what they hypothesized was it was almost a notion of staying true to our roots and kind of an homage to our fathers. Interestingly enough, I had a middle sister who went into radio and television, and she worked very hard to lose the accent.
She lost it.
It's funny because when I would come home after living in New York for 25 years,
they would think you spoke like a Yankee.
They absolutely did. And no one ever accused me of that in New York, let me put it that way.
Well, our good friend Wyndham Robertson is, a leader in breaking the glass ceiling at Time and Fortune, and like you, lonely as a woman in the early stages, and I don't think she ever compromised at all on being a Southerner or speaking the way we speak.
It's interesting also when I went to work for the New York Times, I had taken several speech courses at Columbia when they teach you to present. And so I asked to go back again, and since I knew I would be speaking a lot and presenting a lot, asked to go back and take the course again at Columbia, not just to pass it, but to actually improve my presentation skills. And after the first presentation I gave, the speech instructor called me up and said, let me get this straight, Ms. Abernathy. Do you want to lose the Southern accent? Because if you do, that's going to take years of intensive work. So I said, no, I don't believe I do.
I love this. We're going to do another program about this. But talk about let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about your book, Saving Community Journalism. And maybe we can start out by a rude question, which is, what is working for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal have to do with the challenges that the small town or community and other community newspapers face? I mean, it's a whole different league, isn't it? And how do you approach it?
It most definitely is. But I think we are who we began with, and it's who nurtures us and fosters us in the beginning. And for me, I was really, really lucky. So John Henry Moore, actually hired me. Larnberg Exchange. He told this story when I was inducted into the North Carolina Hall of Fame. That he thought I was a little brash for coming in and suggesting that I had was ready to work at the New York Times, but his father had passed on one other person who had been brash enough to come in and say they were ready to work for the Larnberg Exchange. That person went up the road, was hired by the Southern Pines Pilot, and that was Tom Wicker. So he took a chance on me, thinking that maybe someday I might end up in the same place that Tom Wicker was, which was the New York Times. And I did, but not by the same path. So for me, you know, the first half of my life was really about being a journalist. And most of my formative years were spent both at Larnberg Exchange, the Greensboro Record, the Fayetteville Times. I was one of the 32 people they hired when they started the Fayetteville Times in 1973. Met my husband there, so it turned out to be a very productive time for us. He went on and worked. He had worked at Winston-Salem. He worked in Raleigh. And then I went on and worked in Charlotte. So most of the first decade of our lives was really formed by the North Carolina papers around here. And that was an incredible—
And y'all were working as journalists rather than on the business side.
We were both as journalists.
So you didn't have to worry too much about where that paycheck came from.
No, we didn't at all. And the interesting thing was, at that point when I got to Charlotte, a lot of the editors were kind of aspiring to be publishers at that point. So it was the first time I even actually thought about the business side. But it was something I kind of tucked away. Went on, worked on as a journalist. My husband decided he really wanted to be an Episcopal minister, so he started switching over. We went out to Wichita. Both of us worked out there for about 5 years, and then I was offered a job down in Dallas at the Dallas Times Herald. So it was the last of the great newspaper wars. And fortunately, when I left Knight Ridder, Jim Batten, who was then the CEO, and it spent a good deal of time here in North Carolina helping the Charlotte Observer, among other papers, asked me if I wanted to, said he wanted to continue to be my mentor. And so I tell this story a lot to students because it was kind of my first aha moment. I was the assigning editor the night that a DC-9 caught fire. It turned out the fire was in the restroom. You now have the smoking detector lights in the restroom. You have the lights leading to the exits. You have different foam in the cushions. It turned out it happened. It would originate in Dallas, and it most of the people who died from smoke inhalation because they couldn't get to the exit in time. But I came in. We did a wonderful series of stories, and I tell the story that I actually called the Washington Bureau to get them to work the FAA angle. And the person who picked up the phone was Bill Keller, who became editor of the New York Times. He was working in the Washington Bureau of the Dallas Times Herald then. And he had actually been interviewing the FAA about the problem with the seat material. So we had one story that the competition, the morning news, didn't. I came into work the next morning feeling really, really good.
So you had all that background research information on what burned.
Right. And we had one story that they didn't have. I came in that morning and my heart sunk. Because the trucks that delivered the papers were still in the bay. And that was because of a decision that had been made to kind of phase in the transition from afternoon to morning. Okay. You know, so afternoon was fading at that point, but all the important people that would have seen that story were not going to see it and would look like we had simply chased it after everything else. And I picked up the phone and I called Jim Batten, and he said, well, you know, if you care about journalism, you really ought to learn the business. because in the end, it's going places like Dallas. It's going to be one, not necessarily on the good journalism, because both papers were producing good journalism. It's going to be made on the business decisions, and so that set me off on a path to go back and get a business degree. I haven't looked back since then. It's been a really
intriguing. Has the transformation been complete? Have you moved from completely from being?
I think whatever you are to begin with, when you're a journalist, you always go back there. I like to say I'm bilingual.
I tell you what, Penny Abernathy. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
We need to take a quick break. Okay. We'll come back. I'm talking to Penny Abernathy about her new. Well, we're gonna talk about her new book, Saving Community Journalism. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Penny Abernathy, who is on the faculty, and I can't even say her full name, but she is a journalist dealing with digital media and the business side of journalism. All of that is a topic of her book, new book, Saving Community Journalism, The Path to Profitability, published by UNC Press. And Penny, the book is It's good to talk about your background, because the book is in some respect not a memoir, but it's a reflection of what you've learned on both sides of both writing and also the business side of journalism.
Well, you know, as we were talking, I mean, for me, I was a journalist the first half of my career. Then I switched over, and I switched over in probably in the most fortunate way. My first job out of business school was working with the New York Times Regional Group, which was buying newspapers, small newspapers throughout the South. So in a way, it was like going back to my roots and looking at it in a different sort of way than I had as a journalist, and kind of understanding what the business dynamics were in the community, how important these newspapers were, not just for democracy, but also for the capitalism that was at the grassroots level. Shortly after I went over to started in the planning department, about 3 years later, I got promoted to become business manager of the New York Times newsroom in 89. It actually was a fascinating time. The Berlin Wall was coming down. You had Tiananmen Square. You had the first Persian Gulf War. So it was just an incredible time to be part of that newsroom.
What does the business manager of a newsroom do?
The business manager managed the very large newsroom budget, which was over $100 million at that point.
So if somebody, a news reporter or an editor, proposed a story, they first had to get the money from you?
No, not necessarily. No, each department had a budget, and the part with the news manager was more to make sure that you had the resources to cover things that you needed to. So, for instance, most likely the only time I got involved in things were like with foreign correspondents. So if they lost, had a Humvee that was captured, as we did in the Persian Gulf War, is kind of those things when they would call you to let you know that you were going to have to take a write-off on that. It was more about giving guidance to the department heads to help them make sure they had the resources they needed to cover the news. It was a fascinating time. It was a wonderful editor at that point, Max Frankel, who had a real head not just for how to marshal resources, but how to deploy them in a very effective way. I learned a tremendous amount from him. But it kind of got me away from community newspapers. So for the next 15 years or so, I basically worked on the business side in terms of developing strategy for the New York Times, in terms of the national rollout and a whole bunch of other things, the repositioning of the paper in 97. Moved from there to the Harvard Business Review, where I dealt with taking that magazine basically from an academic journal into a more of a mainstream business journal, forward-thinking business journal, and then ended up at the Wall Street Journal for another really great ride, which was being responsible for the international editions of the Wall Street Journal. Following in the past.
What do you mean being responsible for?
Well, they had the Wall Street Journal Europe and the Wall Street Journal Asia.
What was your business side?
I was the operations person, which meant you're kind of basically the publisher. They don't have two publishers for that.
Well, let me pursue that just a little bit more, because it's an extraordinarily challenging idea when you're thinking of trying to recreate the European edition of was the Herald.
The New York Times was the Herald Tribune, and the Wall Street Journal had the Wall Street Journal Europe.
Yeah, and so you were following in the pathway of somebody who had an established presence there. And did you have to manage the creation of the resources, the advertising? Did you have to go arrange for selling ads in European sector?
Well, you know, the Wall Street Journal was fortunate. It's established the first international edition back in 1976, if I'm remembering correctly, the Asian Wall Street Journal. When everybody else was leaving Saigon, we planted a flag in Asia for that. And so Peter Kahn, who actually was the CEO, had established that. And then his Karen House, who was coincidentally his wife, but also the publisher, had come along, and she had been publisher of those two international editions. So there was a nice, strong history. Most of the journal in Europe had been established in the early 80s.
And were they moneymakers? Were they?
They had been at one time, and they were not when I was sent in. So it was a matter of figuring out how you could turn it around. How could you do it and remain true?
What did happen to make it not a moneymaker?
I think there are a number of things, and when you're looking at something like an international edition, especially if it's published in the U.S., and I had actually learned this lesson at the Wall Street Journal, I mean, at the New York Times. There was a lot of discussion at the New York Times about whether you could take the New York Times outside of New York. Everybody said, oh, so identify with New York. We did a ton of research when I was head of strategy at the New York Times. And what we really determined was it was a New York state of mind. So you could almost determine who would subscribe to the New York Times by how they finished a statement as simple as New York is. So if they said New York is one of the most exciting cultural centers, everything happens, business happens there, they were inclined to be New York Times subscribers because they saw the New York Times as representing that view of the world. If they said it's full of crime, there's no way in the world, even if they had grown up in New York, they were going to subscribe to the New York Times. And so with the Wall Street Journal international editions, what was really critical was figuring out who subscribes to the Wall Street Journal international editions and how is that different from the Financial Times versus the International Herald Tribune. And what we really found is that the primary subscribers to the Wall Street Journal international editions were people who work for Fortune 500 companies, international 500.
American company. International 500. Ones where English is spoken a lot.
Spoken a lot, but had some kind of tie to the global network. So if you look at the 100 largest market cap companies, 40 of them are located outside the U.S., but they're still, because it's a global economy, and the U.S. is one of the largest economies, they're very tied to that. So they saw, in the same way people saw the New York Times as kind of a New York representation, the Wall Street Journal represents that American side. If you were more into a European company, you would go and subscribe to the FT, for instance.
Now, does that piece of information give you the wherewithal to turn it around
absolutely it did. I think part of what had happened was you had had some people come in and decide that it could be a really big a large circulation. And when you get that way, you don't have the target. So advertisers really want to know who they're reaching.
Yeah, I love this. So that the Wall Street Journal, even though I might want a funny page in there, I'm not their target. If somebody comes to me and say, what would it take to take the Wall Street Journal and need a good funny page? I'm not the target.
Yeah.
And so you find out who the target is and deliver the paper straight for them so that they will get what they need.
Right, exactly. And so
Though it's a smaller audience than you might really want.
Well, and actually we have magazines to thank for this. Magazines after television went from being mass to being very niche. So advertisers love it when they have a very efficient way to reach a certain audience. So with the Harvard Business Review, for instance, you had a huge number of people in the C-suites. In the same thing with the international editions, you can then go saying these are people who work for international conglomerates. They have some kind of presence or some kind of reason to know what's going on in the U.S., but they see the Wall Street Journal as providing the information they need.
The Daily Mail or Das Bild may have a whole lot larger circulation, but they're not the people that you want to reach.
Right, exactly. And so for me, what was really interesting about that is I began to think about not just a mass audience, but also one about who are you really, what is the profile of the audience that you're reaching from all of that. And that's what played in large part to when I came back here to think about community journalism.
Well, we're visiting with Penny Abernathy. We're talking about talking about her book, Saving Community Journalism. We will talk about that after the short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Penny Abernathy. She's on the faculty at the UNC School of Journalism and Mass Communication, getting a lot of attention because she's written a new book called Saving Community Journalism, The Path to Profitability. And it is a message of hope in at a time when all of us, both those who try to run the newspapers and those who are dependent on them, worry about the future for community journalism. How has the career that we've just been having a good time talking about in terms of these big New York Times and Wall Street Journal challenges prepare you to come back and teach us how we can save our community newspapers that we love so much?
I think we're all of us through life are a sum of all the experiences we've had in our careers. And as I mentioned before, I started out in community journalism, got a really good foundation in it. Mm-hmm. North Carolina does it, I think, about the best of any state in the union. And part of that, I think, is we've never had the large metros, the really large mm-hmm. metros kind of dominating here. So, and it's also part of this school. The school has turned out some incredible journalists. So you get good foundation there. I go off, I see that, and I think most people assumed when I came here I would be looking at helping the New York Times and the Wall Street mm-hmm. Journal figure out the future. And a couple of interesting things happened to me. I started realizing there were a lot of people worried about that, and some of them had were on the staff, and they would figure it out. While everybody was so focused on what was happening on the metros and what was happening on the national, nobody was really looking at the country's other 11,000 newspaper.
Tell us what you learned in terms of we would have a notion that these are challenging times for community newspapers for the same reason it's a challenge for all newspapers. But tell us about the challenges that you've learned that when I say small town newspaper, I mean community newspapers even in larger settings. What are the challenges? And then talk about how you suggest that that we meet them.
Well, I think it's kind of important to kind of have a timeline. So, if you look at the large papers like the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer, Washington Post, they started feeling the pinch somewhere between 2002 and 2005. And part of it is they lost their classified advertising, which is it just went with the internet, right? But if you look in a community like Whiteville, it really did not hit them.
Right, some people don't know where Columbus County is.
Whiteville in Columbus County, 50 miles from Wilmington, down in
old tobacco country.
It's old tobacco country and lots of swampland, and very rural. One of the most only 55,000 in one of the largest counties in the state in landmass. You sit there, and for them, the print paper was what it was. You didn't have to worry about the internet. It wasn't wired. It was
it was the way we would remember it 50 years ago. We'd get our paper and we'd read it.
You absolutely did, right? I was actually quite fortunate. The McCormick Foundation at that point had been working with papers in West Virginia and Kentucky about how to adopt the new digital tools. The problem, of course, is once you got journalists to adopt the new digital tools, how do you then get your readers to also do that? So they came down here and said, given your experience, would you be interested in looking at papers in rural North Carolina to see if you could help them come up with a business model? And I called the North Carolina Press Association, and their only stipulation was it needed to be in a county that was economically challenged. And so
this is your funder.
My funder said that from McCormick, the McCormick Foundation. And so we identified three papers, Whiteville down in Columbus County, Little Washington, as we call it, over in Beaufort, and Wilkesboro, the Wilkes County paper up there. And we got them all three together, said, would you be willing to be guinea pigs for us? Mm-hmm. And I think they all were in a different place. I mean, there was a good deal of skepticism still in 2008, 2009 as to whether the internet was going to reach rural America. They said, yeah, sure, but, you know,
this is a question, but they weren't yet feeling, because of the special nature of rural readership and a little bit behind in terms of adopting the resources of the internet, more people were still reading the newspaper at that point. The challenges may not have been felt as strongly there.
Well, you know, if you talk to Les High, who's the editor at Whiteville, he'll tell you it wasn't until 2009 that he actually felt it. So the recession of 2008 caused a lot of businesses to go under. And when that started happening, they started noticing it wasn't bouncing back. So when you talk to people, to publishers and editors in rural areas in 2009, there was still a hope it would bounce back to where it had been in 2007.
Like always.
Mm-hmm. This was just going to be it was a bigger correction than normal, but it would go back to the way it did. And I think by the beginning, as Les will tell you, by the beginning of 2010, he was realizing it was going to be a long, slow slide.
So you had already made contact with Les Hyde, the publisher of the Whiteville paper.
Whiteville News Reporter, right.
And then you had contacts with two other,
at this point were all independent, and that was one of the reasons we wanted to look at independent newspapers, because we figured if we came up with something, it would be much easier to work with them for flexibility purposes on doing this. So what we did is go in, and we did, during that 2009, while they basically asked a lot of questions of us, which was, you know, appropriately skeptical at that point, we went in and did a lot of market research in those counties. Les was very concerned, for instance, he had had a website since 1998, but he was very concerned about putting content up on the web page because he thought it was going to detract from the print readership of the paper. What we found, we went in and did a very simple survey I had used at the New York Times, and this is what I really wanted to do with community newspapers, is take tools that we had learned, that I had used and learned at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and see if I could apply them to local newspapers. So there was a very simple tool that had been developed by a man named Fred Reichel, in which he determined that loyalty of a customer is your single best indicator of future profitability.
And say that again, because that rang really strong in your book.
Right. And so what his hypothesis was, which he spent a decade proving, is that there is a strong correlation between the loyalty of the customers that you have and your future profitability. Now, you sit there and you say, why would that be? Well, because they buy more, they pay more.
And they stick with you more.
And they sell more. Mm. They recommend you to friends and family. So if you think about it, if somebody says to you, the Whiteville News Reporter is really neat, I recommend you get to read it. You read it because it'll help you get to know the community. And it's somebody you know and trust. You're going, that person's reputation is also on the line. So the test would be to ask readers on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being highest, would you recommend this to a friend or family, and a friend or colleague? And only if they gave it a 9 or 10 are they loyal customers. Well, what we had the scores for the New York Times. When we went into Whiteville, the scores were even higher than the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and those are really high for newspapers. And what we also found out was we went in and looked at what's the profile of the person who's reading only the print, what's the person who's reading both your website and your print edition, and what's the profile of somebody who's only accessing you online. And what we discovered, A, that the loyalty was really strong among both your print and your print and online readers.
Even higher on only print?
Even higher on only print, okay? But here's the problem. All of the print readers were over 60. All of the print-only readers.
I mean, right.
But then if you look down and say, well, who's looking at both the print and the online, they were about 15 years younger. And if you talk to them, they were looking at the two as complementary, not as competitive. Mm-hmm. That was a huge insight. Then if you looked at who was only looking at it online, you got another insight, which is that they were even younger. So, and what actually occurred is, as Les pointed out recently in a presentation I heard him give, is that what it took was understanding that when you pick up the paper and five people have died and they've all been print subscribers, they're not being replaced by 20 and 30-year-olds. They have a different way of accessing news. And for him, that was his aha moment when he suddenly realized that he wasn't going to compete with himself as he started developing the website and putting new material up there. In fact, it was a way to bring in new people, and that the print readers weren't going to be mad with him
Let me ask you this, and we're going to have to do this again does that insight, which I bet you is paralleled in many other rural newspapers, that your new readers are accessing your information on the web, and your old readers are not, or they're dying, as they.
Right.
So does that mean that there is that to succeed, a community newspaper has to enter into a process of a gradual transformation in the way it delivers its information and advertising from all print 10 years ago to all web 20 years from now?
I think it's too early to know whether – I don't think print will ever go away in some form. I think it's going to be substantially diminished. So my own thought is, and if you talk to most people who run daily newspapers, they will tell you the day's probably coming fairly soon when we won't have a seven-day delivery. It may be three. It may be four. It will be an important component, but it will not be the main – it won't be 7 days a week. And so the really sharp daily publishers are trying to train their readers to move over.
Now, this is another insight for me, that a smart publisher like Les is also nudging his readers to begin to use the print and the internet availability together.
Together.
So he would even want to nudge somebody as old as I am into trying out the extra things that he could give me.
Well, for instance, in one of the ways that newspapers have found that they can do that with someone over the age of 60 is the obits. Have the obits out there and have them for free, because there's so much more you can do with an obit online than you can in the other way. So, it is a matter of getting – and the other thing, though, too, is our habits are changing very, very fast. That was the other really big surprise to me, is you get these national surveys that are done showing how, so many people access online news. I think more than half of people, somewhere in 2010 or 2011, most people started accessing news online rather than in a newspaper. And I thought that would not be the case out in rural areas. And it actually took somebody from West Virginia to point out to me why the habits out in the rural areas are tracking almost identically with national averages.
And why is it?
It's because most people in rural areas commute into a place that is wired. So they actually they have that same expectation. So if you think about how you process news and information now, you toggle between various devices. So it might be a print newspaper, it might be a tablet, it might be a phone. And so if you're a newspaper, you need to think of yourself not as being on paper, but as being accessible across whatever medium the person is using.
We're visiting with Penny Abernathy about her book, Saving Community Journalism. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Penny Penelope. Is that how, we pronounce that Penny.
Penny sounds really good.
I love that name. I've got, Penny Abernathy is on the faculty at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, and she's the author of a new book, Saving Community Journalism. Had a fantastic career. We talked some about that. And we also talked about some of the challenges that the small news or the community newspapers that are the subject of your book face. One of them is just paring down the budget.
Yeah.
And you have a nice way of saying this. You say we have to do away with our legacy costs. But what you're really saying is you got to be a mean manager on your spending.
It's part of that, but it's also understanding where you add value, right, in the digital age. And, the notion of printing and distributing something, a physical product every day, that really had value back in the 19th century. It was a barrier to entry for people who wanted to come into your market, because you had to be able to afford a press and a whole fleet of trucks to go out and do it. But if you think about how we consume news today, what you really have to do is saying, maybe 60% of my budget is devoted to printing and distributing the newspaper. That's not adding value that anybody else.
Well, how can you change? I mean, that's just a fixed cost. How do you change that?
Well, it surprises most people that most newspapers don't even print their own newspaper today. It's being consolidated, and so the first thing you do is you get someone else to print your newspaper and someone else to distribute it, and there are huge cost savings from all of that.
It's a hard thing for me because, I just love the newspaper, hearing the sounds of the presses, getting your hands dirty and having that contact with real working people.
Yeah. It's interesting because every newspaper I've talked to that is outsourced, and I understand it, because you still walk into the News and Observer today and there's still the smell of paper that's still there, or the ink, and there's nothing that beats the sound of the press when it starts off. But the unfortunate reality is, unless you can keep a press running 24/7, you just can't make money.
On the positive side of it, even a large community newspaper, which in the old days would have to have its own press, now can get it done by somebody else who concentrates on that a lot cheaper in the long run.
Yeah, do it much more efficiently.
And it's competitive.
It's competitive. You can save money. You can then get your distribution outsourced to someone else who will do it too, so that they're all running the same route. So they might be delivering 5 and 6 papers at the same time.
Now, that's not any real magic. People understand that.
It's not. But then the other thing you need to do, and this is the hard part, is you need to get in and make sure everybody understands that they have to produce for both the print and the digital.
Now, how do you do that?
You try to do it so that you keep the historians on the staff, the journalists who know the community.
Most resistant to the changeover, but most valuable in terms of the attachment to the community.
They have the community history. They know who the stakeholders are. They know what the community.
You have to say to them, all right, we love you and we value you, but unless you change, we can't use you anymore.
Well, you know, it's interesting because several of my colleagues here at the university have worked with what would we call the old salts that were the journalists back in the days that taught everyone. And their notion is that usually what you can do is sit down with somebody like this over time and explain to them that you're just giving them more digital tools, that you really need them, but you really need them to adopt the new tools and that they come around. And unfortunately, if they don't, you give them a chance to make the transition, but if they don't, then unfortunately life has moved on.
Is that true? Well, nothing's
right.
Everything, but in general, is that true for these really, I think I'm the old codger who wrote, like as you mentioned in the Laurinburg paper, the column that everybody read, but
yeah,
or columns like that written by a genuine local person that who has lots of fans. Now, if he or she says, "Look, I'll write this thing for you, but I'm not changing. I'm gonna give it to you every week, but don't ask me to be up all night online."
Well, I think that what you have to do is decide how that person is adding value, and that's what you really need to do on an individual basis. So, you know, sometimes it's very easy, and you need to look at it for everything, every process. So one of the things that people who've done this sort of thing before say that you really need to do, if you're a publisher, you need to say, if we succeed, how will we look in 5 years? To our customers first, our employees second, and then our shareholders third. And what that does is set up a real neat focus, not on the person who's doing the column, but on the customers of the newspaper. So if you can get that person to start understanding that your media habits are changing just as mine are, and how they continue to add value in that, then I think that's the beginning of a really productive conversation.
We've just got a minute. And I've got a burning question, and that is that the success that you had in North Carolina seemed to be with the family-owned newspapers, but by and large, our small community-serving papers are now owned by larger groups, like the one that you worked with at the New York Times. Now, is it possible that these accountants who run the large groups can buy into what you're selling?
I think it depends on who the owner is. So if you get an owner like the New York Times, which was willing to make an investment in the Santa Rosa Press Democrat so he could set up an in-house digital ad agency, they can spread the risk around a lot more properties and understand that it's a long-term return. If you get someone who owns you as an investment, you're probably not going to be any better off than you would have been. And then the problem with being independent is exactly the one I mentioned in the Rutland Herald. You have to go it alone. So you really do. You got a much shorter ramp to failure. So you really do have to be very careful about how you marshal the resources and how fast you do it. There's no simple answer for anybody, but there is a path to profitability. It's just that you've got to take that leap. You've got to imagine what things are going to be 5 years from now, given the trends, where they're going.
So you're just a counselor, encourager, and say, go do it. It's possible.
Others have done it. They're doing it. They're making the transition. And I guess I would leave with the words that Les High says. He says he wished he'd understood 5 years ago. It's not about a series of incremental steps. It's about transformational change. It's a very creative time if you choose it, but it can be a scary time, but it can be a creative time. It's a matter of how you view the opportunity.
Well, lots more to talk about, and lots more in your great book, Saving Community Journalism, that we haven't covered. But thanks, Penny Abernathy, for giving us an introductory session.
Well, thank you for this. Appreciate it.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.